So we will be in Acts chapter 26 today, essentially just started Acts 26 last week. I'm not really going to go through many, if any, of Mickey's slides because I want to let him do that. So I've got some other stuff that I want to look at. All right, so in Acts chapter 26, this is one of the defenses of Paul. Which one is it, according to Mickey's slides? Yeah, which number? Some other number.
What
number of defense is this of Paul's? Fifth. Okay. All right. So if I brought Mickey's slides up, you know, you'd say, it would say fifth defense. Okay. So Chris already mentioned them all, right? So the people, the Sanhedrin, Felix, Festus, and now Agrippa. Where is this taking place? Caesarea, okay. And as soon as my technician gets my my computer figured out why I can't get full screen here. Well, but anyway, Caesarea, as you'll see, we got, of course, the entire Bible lands, as I call them here, on the map. And, of course, we've got Israel down here. And if I were Mickey, I'd just, you know, draw a curve and a couple of lakes and say, that's Israel right there. That's all you need, right? So there's Caesarea. We'll get a little closer than that, though. So Caesarea is on the coast of the Mediterranean. And as we zoom way in, you can see in this area right here, areas where there are old ruins where the original port of Caesarea might have been. It was when it was built by one of the Herods, it was called Caesarea Maritima, because there's already another Caesarea further inland. My understanding is that the port that was made there is an artificial port. There's no real good place to have a port exactly right there. So that's where we are as far as in the scheme of things as far as location goes. And Paul, of course, was there making his defense before whom at this time now in chapter 26? Agrippa and everybody else at all. Yeah, that's right. So Festus was there too, and Bernice, right? And then it says the major people in the city.
And military people, did you say that?
Yeah, it does say. It mentions, yeah, military-type people also. I can't imagine that in the description that says the principal people of the city, that would include any Jews at all. I'm thinking that this is just the Roman populace here. That's just supposition on my part, but there's no reason to draw any conclusion that there are any Jews there to make any charges against him at this time of Agrippa. Now, of course, when he had his previous meeting with Festus, alphabetical order, right? With Festus, then there were Jews that had come up from Jerusalem to bring accusation against him. But in this instance, that doesn't appear to be the case. It's just a recitation of things before the King Agrippa, who was Herod Agrippa, what, the second. I was going to mention before we moved terribly on, because I was listening as I was trying to get last week's posted up on the website, as I was listening to that, there was Reba and Mickey had a good discussion about the what Mickey calls temporal consequences of doing things. And as to whether or not Paul actually received, as it were, as I understand it, you know, many or any temporal consequences because of the things that he had done. And so when I look at that, I think, well, did Paul or Saul receive temporal consequences due to the fact that he persecuted Christians? And when I look at that, then all I have to do is look, I think, at Acts the 9th chapter and verse 16. Do you know what that says, Chris? Since you agreed with me quickly.
Yes. That's where God, Jesus, told against Saul, "I will show you how much you must suffer for my name's sake."
That's right. So in that place, and that's Acts 9:16, the Holy Spirit or Jesus said that through Ananias there in Damascus that he would suffer many things for his name's sake. And if we also look in 1 Peter, the second and third chapters, there's discussions there about suffering for. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 20. Peter here says in verse 20 of 1 Peter chapter 2, "For what glory is it if when ye sin and are buffeted for it, ye shall take it patiently? But if when ye do well and suffer for it, ye shall take it patiently, this is acceptable with God." I thought, Paul did a lot of things well after he was no longer Saul, and yet he continued to suffer for it. So when we see indeed that, as the Holy Spirit said, that you're going to suffer, or Jesus said you're going to suffer for my name, here we see that people suffer for good. And certainly Paul did that. We go on in chapter 3 and verses 14 and 17. It says other things similar. 1 Peter 3 verse 14 says, "But even if ye should suffer for righteousness' sake, blessed are ye, and fear not their fear, neither be troubled." And verse 17, for it is better if the will of God should so will that ye suffer for well-doing than for evil-doing. Chris, looks like you have your hand halfway up. Oh, Randy, go ahead.
I get the impression that you're kind of mixing two different principles here. But what you're talking about here is suffering for righteousness' sake. What Nikki was talking about last week was suffering for things that we have done that we are justly going to receive retribution. Such as he gave the example of the thief on the cross.
Right.
Even though he was forgiven by Jesus, that he still suffered crucifixion.
Right.
Another good example would have been David. David, even though his sins were forgiven by God, still suffered because of the things that he did later on in his life.
Okay. That's right. Yep. Chris, did you have something?
Yeah, to me, the point about his suffering after the road to Damascus and after he became a child of God was kind of due to what he said in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 10, you know, "By the grace of God I am what I am. His grace toward me did not prove vain, but I labored even more than them all." He suffered because his response to what he had done previously was, "I've got to do everything in the rest of my life for the cause of Christ. And if by laboring more than them all means that I suffer, then I suffer."
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, Carolyn.
In addition, he was pretty prominent, known for, you know, collecting these Christians and causing them to suffer. And must have had many friends who were, you know, colleagues who were like-minded. And then to turn, it seems like that would have made them angry and even more likely to focus on him. Maybe, you know, we don't know what happened to all the other disciples exactly, but that might be a reason why, because he was known.
And who did Paul meet on one of his journeys as he's coming back to Jerusalem that might have been one of those people that was angry with him? Philip, right?
Oh, and, okay. I was talking about the higher ups.
Oh, the higher ups of the Jewish, yeah.
The guys he held coats for.
Right.
And then for him to turn.
Turn, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's like I've said a couple of times. Would Saul have accepted Paul? I don't think so. Randy.
And I think similar to what she had indicated in verse 26 of chapter 9, that when he went to Jerusalem, he tried to join himself to the disciples. But he wasn't able to because they didn't really believe him.
Right.
He was one of them. So that his effectiveness at teaching others was diminished.
Yes.
And I think you could also say, in a sense, because of all of the persecution he had so heartily done against Christians, when he did turn and become a Christian, then the Jewish authorities were after him even more. They would not have persecuted him as much if he had just been, if he had never done all those things in persecuting Christians.
Sure, yeah. I just, the gist of the thing that I got when Reba was talking was that had Paul done anything for which he was criminally responsible? I don't think he did. And so the thief on the cross, they did things for which they were criminally responsible. Saul did nothing for which he was criminally responsible and could not be held liable under the laws of the Roman government for the things that he had done. But the Jews didn't much like him after he turned traitor, as it were. The Christians didn't much like him while he was still Saul, because he was dragging them off in chains to prisons and things like that. So when I look at these verses from whatever I said, Acts 9 and 1 Peter 2 and 3, what I'm looking at is the fact is that Paul, as he became a Christian, was told that he would suffer for the things that he did toward God for which he was criminally responsible. And he did suffer for that because he persecuted Christians. And he changed that around. But yet he still had to suffer many things, Acts 9, 16. Okay. Anyway, I just thought I'd bring that up because I heard that again as I went through the recording. All right. I wanted to then go into the slides. As near as I can tell, we'll see. None of which, I think, will be Mickey's slides. We'll see if I get to any of them or not. But what I was looking at is that as I look in Acts chapter 26, of course, it starts off in verse 1, "And Agrippa said unto Paul." Now, what's Agrippa's nominal title? King, right? And the person who's also with Agrippa, not his wife, but the other man, is the governor, right? Festus. And there's a lot of, you know, important people there. I think pomp and circumstance was mentioned last week. And apparently military people also. All of this leads me to thinking of, well, first of all, let's find out where we are as far as on the timeline of the world goes. I think it's important for us to know exactly where we are. Anybody have an idea of what time, what year we're talking about here in Acts chapter 26, or approximate year? Randy?
From the late 50s.
Okay, so what I want to do is I want to go through the emperors of Rome, the first five of them, because they made up sort of a dynasty. And then after Nero, suffered a grand bout of lead poisoning, at least that's what it would have been in these days. Then there was a different sort of dynasty that went on after that. But so I wanted to look at some of these things because there's certainly been a little bit of confusion about the way that these people are called sometimes. And we need to make sure that we understand who we are and what we're talking about here. So if we look at the first emperor of the Roman Empire, now it would appear that that's a lot later than you would think it is, but the empire apparently was not actually codified, was not actually set up really until Gaius Octavius Thurinus, who we know as Caesar Augustus, was established on the throne. At that time, there was a centralization of power. And the Roman Empire actually became the empire at that time. And he was the first emperor of the Roman Empire. He reigned from January 16th of 27 BC. I don't know how they come up with these dates. But, of course, obviously the calendar then wasn't the same as it is now. I think one of the people that was looking at, that has a commentary, and he was looking back at when the date of creation was. And he says, I think it was about April 15th of 4007 BC. He says, any closer I dare not get. And I thought, okay. So I go. But anyway, the data that I was looking at, which you can get on Wikipedia and places like that, indicates that he reigned from January of 27 BC to August of 14 AD. So this is the person called Caesar Augustus. Under him, there were a number of people that were ruling in Judea at that time, of whom the most important that we think about is Herod the Great. My understanding, and I don't have the Herods, I was going to do the Herods, but I got to going on the emperors, and I thought, well, I'm not sure I'm going to get through the emperors, much less go into the Herods. But if you have the book on the history and geography of the Bible story, you look in chapter 41, That's the chapter about the Herods. You can see a good discussion there of the Herods, and there's a place there for each one of the Herods, from Herod the Great all the way up to where we are now, Herod Agrippa II. So quite an involved thing there, and a lot of, what would you call it, drama in the things that are going on in there. Anyway, this man, Gaius Octavius Thurinus, he was born in 63 B.C. in Rome, and then he died in 14 A.D., which suspiciously is at the end of his reign also. None of these people retired. They all died, either in office or had a mysterious sudden illness. Anyway, we know him as Caesar Augustus. If you look in Luke, the second chapter, in verse 1, I'm going to get there first. Just go ahead and read it. Anybody there yet?
Luke
2:1.
Now in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census shall be taken of all the inhabited earth.
All right. So we realize that this, at the beginning of the, essentially at the book of Luke, is starting the story of the birth of Jesus, right? Because we have here that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus to enroll all the people. And so who were some of the people that enrolled that were important in this era? Mary and Joseph. They left where and went to where? They left Nazareth and went to Bethlehem. I think it's interesting to note that though we have a number of accounts here in the Gospels that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, there is no mention in the New Testament after this time of the fact that he's from Bethlehem. I think that's curious, whatever. It apparently wasn't important, because the fact of the matter is that he was born in Bethlehem. There is another religion that will tell you that he was born in Jerusalem, because it says that he'll be born in the city of David. And they say, well, you know, that lower southern portion of Jerusalem, that was called the city of David, you know. I go, yeah, at David's time, it was called the city of David. Yes, that's true. It was also called several other things. And then by the time Solomon came around, that thing was no longer called the city of David, and it was no longer a separate portion. You'll remember that when we were talking about the Temple Mount, we talked about those two gates that were down like toward the bottom, Huldah's gates, I think they were called. People could enter into the temple through the tunnel and come up through the stairway. That area is in the area that in ancient times was called the city of David. But the Mormons feel that he was born in Jerusalem because it said that he would be born in the city of David. You go, the city of David was Bethlehem. That's where David was born. It's where he was raised and lived a good portion of his life. And so just because another place is called city of David doesn't mean all of a sudden we can say that Jesus was born somewhere else. That's another one of those things that you just wonder where people came up with that. This man, Caesar Augustus, Caesar was originally a family name way back when. And of course, all these people appear to be related to somebody. And so back when Julius Caesar was around, who was assassinated, as I recall, in 44 BC, which was significantly before this time, his name, Julius Caesar, was actually the family name. But later, the term Caesar simply got used as a reference to the emperor. So this is the Caesar. Now, I would think that after this first reign of five kings, that meant that might have fallen out of favor, because we then went to a different dynasty, and therefore Caesar was not part of the family name anymore. The word Augustus simply means venerable. Or Merriam-Webster says, made sacred, especially by religious or historical association. As a matter of fact, even though it wasn't until a couple of emperors later that we really got into the people trying to call themselves gods, we understand that even here with Caesar Augustus, that he wanted to use a title that would at least indicate that he was of divine appointmentship. Okay, that he wasn't there just because, you know, he killed somebody or got elected or something like that, but rather there was a certain amount of divinity in his appointing and becoming emperor. So anyway, this takes us then through 14 AD, which is not very far. We understand from secular things that Jesus was born in about what we call, what, about 4 BC, something like that. So at the time that Caesar Augustus died, Jesus might have been about 18 years old. So this was a few years after the time, 6 years after the time that he would have been in the temple, right? He was 12 years old, wasn't he, when his parents found him in the temple talking with all the rabbis, the priests, and I'm going to call them rabbis, priests and elders. So that's how this Caesar Augustus thing came about. Because as we look at Gaius Octavius Thurinus, we don't see any Caesar or Augustus in there. So why is the Bible calling him Caesar Augustus? Because that was the name that he adopted. If you look at some of the things online, it's referred to as a regnal name. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that. It's a regal name. Yeah. So you see a lot of them are like this long, you know, about 12 names long, and I have all sorts of this sort of stuff in it, Caesar and Augustus and all that sort of thing. All right, so after Gaius died, I think he was like 75 when he died, if I recall correctly, and if I added correctly, it's 27 plus 14. No, that's his reign. So 63 plus 14, that'd be 77, right? So he's about 75, as I recall, when he died. After that, then, of course, then comes Tiberius Claudius Nero. Don't mistake him for the person whom we think of as Nero. Once again, this is a family name, Nero. He's the second emperor of the Roman Empire. He started in September of the year 14, and he reigned through March of 37. So we're still in the very early phases of the church at this time, as far as that goes. And, of course, these people weren't particularly interested in what was going on in Palestine at that time anyway. They just knew that they were a bunch of troublemakers and that they needed to stomp on them whenever they had the opportunity to do so. So this man, Tiberius, he was born in November of 42 B.C. in Rome, and he died March of 37 A.D. So he was a few years old also. When he died, looks like 79 years old, right? So, this man was the great grand uncle of the Nero that we know about, or that we've heard about, as it were, great grand uncle. I'll let you figure that one out. But he was born Tiberius Claudius Nero, but he became known as Tiberius Caesar. You look at Luke the third chapter, and in verse one, Luke the third chapter, and in verse one, you there, Melissa? To read that for us.
Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, and Herod was tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip was tetrarch of the region of Etruria, and
Trachonitis,
and Lysanias was tetrarch of Abilene.
Okay. I knew you'd love all.
Oh, yeah.
So notice that this is the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar. So right here in chapter 3 of Luke, we have a date, do we not? In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar. So if Tiberius Caesar started to reign on September 18th of the year 14, and this is the 15th year, what year is it? Quickly, I have up here 29 A.D., so we can look at the fact that as the Bible is speaking here, we understand that we've got a fairly hard and fast date that we can look at here. 29 A.D. That's a few years ago, but it gives us a better idea of exactly what we're talking about here. So, and the reason that Luke mentions that here is that this is the beginning of John the Baptist preaching. That's what he's talking about. So John the Baptist started preaching in about 29 A.D. Carolyn.
Is Tetrarch below governor?
I'm not sure what the hierarchy of Tetrarch is, though I understand that the governor was called something else and it wasn't Tetrarch. Yeah, I'm unclear on that. It might be more the equivalent of what Herod Agrippa II was in the text that we're looking at now. I think, because he was over more area, whereas Festus was over a more localized area, though it appears that their areas kind of overlap, sort of.
Tetrarch and governor below that?
It might have been. We'll have to look that up. That's your research question for next week. Interestingly enough, this is, of course, not the only time that this is mentioned. If we go to John, the 6th chapter and verse 1, of course, you'll remember that as we talk about the Sea of Galilee at this time, that we're referring also to, after these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. So the Sea of Tiberias was named after the emperor at that time, which was somewhere after or during the year 29 AD. It's probably, very close to that time. And then if you just scroll down a little bit further to verse 23, it just mentions, howbeit there came boats from Tiberias nigh unto the place where they ate the bread after the Lord had given thanks. When it says that there came boats from Tiberias, does that mean there came boats from the lake of Tiberias? No, it was a city or a town called Tiberias, also on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. So we see not only was there a lake called, or a sea called the Sea of Tiberias, there was also a town in that area called Tiberias. So far, of the two emperors that we've looked at Gaius and also at Tiberius, we understand that the Bible mentions them specifically a couple of times already, and we can pretty much date where we are at that time. Do you have a comment?
Just interesting on the word tetrarch, looking up real quick. The prefix tetra actually means four.
Four, yeah.
And so it means one ruled over a fourth of the kingdom.
Ah, okay.
Technically, but then it...
Right.
And I'm sure it wasn't exactly a fourth.
There was something that I was reading, and I don't know that I have it in the notes that I have here, but one of the people that was like king or something down there, it might have been Herod the Great. I think he divided his kingdom, as it were, up into four in his will. So whether that's where Tetrarch came from, I don't know. But yeah, interesting. Yeah, I realized that there was a number there, but I didn't remember which number it was. Tetra. Okay. So that takes care then of Caesar Augustus from Luke 2:1. And also Tiberius Caesar from Luke 3:1. And it gives us a good date as to when we're talking about some of the things that are going on as we're talking. The next emperor, the third emperor of the Roman Empire, is Gaius Julius Caesar. Now, this man was simply named after his relative, Julius Caesar, who died in 44 B.C., if I get the name right. He reigned from March of 37 A.D., to January of 41 A.D. You notice that he died of lead poisoning rather quickly. So he was known as Caligula. Now, I think a lot of us who have studied any history at all have heard of the evil Caligula. But there is no reference to him or allusion to him that I can find in the New Testament at all. But he was born in Actium, which was about 25 miles south of Rome, in August of 12 A.D., and he died mysteriously in January of 41 A.D. He's the one that began referring to himself as a god. Now, the thing is that as we look at poor Caligula here, we understand that at some time during his reign as emperor, he became gravely ill with something. Some people thought that perhaps he had been poisoned. And when he recovered from that, his entire demeanor was changed. So whether he had some sort of mental breakdown or he just felt, I can't trust people anymore, he just changed from that time. But you'll notice that he didn't reign very long, 4 years, right? Just short of 4 years. Carolyn, do you have your hand up?
Okay, I haven't read up on it, but lead poisoning could be caused by what you're eating off of.
No, I'm just referring to that in the local vernacular. In other words, if we were to go execute somebody now, he dies suddenly of lead poisoning. So, sorry. He died of knife poisoning.
I was just going to say there are conditions that could certainly change your personality.
Yes, there certainly are. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, certain. Thank you. So.
People have that choice
in
them, considering
that. Exactly. Yeah. Now, the two historians, Philo and Seneca, They referred to him as an insane emperor who was self-absorbed, was angry, killed on a whim, and indulged in too much spending and sex. So it would behoove you to read the life story of Caligula. It's interesting. But killing people was not foreign to him, including family. So, a lot of not very good things to say about Gaius Julius Caesar, the third emperor of the Roman Empire. Now, Tiberius Claudius Nero Germanicus. Once again, the family name Nero is in there, but this is not the Nero. So he's the fourth emperor of the Roman Empire. He reigned from January of 41, suspiciously after Caligula died, till October of 54. We are now getting into the area of what we're talking about. Certainly, this person was around, was the emperor, while Paul was on his journeys, or at least part of them anyway, in 54. So he was born. It turns out that he was actually the uncle of this previous emperor of Caligula. And he was actually born in August of 10 BC. So he was born significantly for, I think it was like 24 years. Yeah. 22 years before the previous emperor was born. So he was an uncle of some sort. This man was born in Gaul because his dad was stationed there as a soldier. He was the first person that became an emperor that was not born in Italy. He was born in 10 BC and he died in October of 54. So he was 64 years old when he died. And so when we look at Acts, the 11th chapter and verse 28, you'll remember this. It's our first discussion about Agabus in Acts 11 and 28. Anybody there yet? All right. So in Acts 11, we have discussion about the church in Antioch of Syria. And it says, now in those days there came down prophets from Jerusalem unto Antioch, in verse 27. And there stood up one of them named Agabus, and signified by the Spirit there should be a great famine over all the world, which came to pass in the days of Claudius. And every man, according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren that dwelt in Judea, which also they did, sending it to the elders by the hand of Barnabas and Saul. Now, if you look in history, there doesn't appear to be a great worldwide famine in that everybody's crops started producing all over the world. What happened, though, was that there was a big famine in Egypt caused by something to do with the Nile River, either flooding too much or not enough or something like that. And then simultaneously, or somewhere close thereunto, there was a drought in Syria. And what this did was that it meant that the crops that the people in the Roman Empire depended on were no longer available. And so the prices would have gone through the roof. The availability of goods were not there anymore. And so, indeed, it could be called a worldwide famine because things were not available anymore because of more localized lack of goods in other areas from producing countries that could no longer supply what they had before. So, yeah, Chris.
This is the same man in Acts 18 that drove all the Christians out of Rome?
I didn't see that, but though I did see that, when did he start? In January of 41. There was a mention of one of the other emperors that required all the Jews in Rome who were of army age to enlist in the army. And then if they weren't of that age, or if they're a woman, they were to get out of Dodge or die. And so that, however, seems much too far back for this. I didn't look and see if Claudius was the one that exiled the...
Yeah, Acts 18:2 says, and he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry, I missed that part. All right, I remembered, and I was going to look that up and didn't, that whether it said that he had recently come from Italy. So that's, of course, rules out the person who exiled all the Jews in 14 AD, because we're up in the 50s now. So Claudius is also mentioned here. I neglected to find that. Okay, Claudius.
What's that person?
18:2. Yeah, so we need to add that in there. Acts 18:2, then he expelled the Jews from Rome. And maybe it was for the same reason. I don't know. But there was some reason, I'm sure, that he did that. And then, so he was the fourth emperor of the Roman Empire. So he's mentioned a couple of times then in the New Testament. So of the four people that we've looked at so far, three of them have been specifically mentioned in the New Testament. And we can put dates with a lot of the things that we're talking about here. And then now if we go to the last of the five, the fifth emperor of the Roman Empire, Lucius Domitius, and that other name, that other word. Anyway, he is the one that later became, his original name was Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus. That was his official name. This was the Nero, as it were, that we know about, that is famous, infamous, whichever way you want to look at it. He reigned from October of 54 to June of 68. Now, that was only 2 years before what happened?
Destruction
of Jerusalem by Titus, right? Titus, after he destroyed Jerusalem, within a year or a couple of years, he became emperor also. That was in another dynasty, another dynasty. All right. He was also born in Antium. He was born in December of 37 AD, and he died in June of 68 AD. So this takes care of a lot of the area that we're talking about now. His reign, of course, from October of 54 to June of 68, took 14 years of times when Paul would have been moving around somewhat. But that was his official name, was Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus. This is the emperor to which Paul made his appeal. Randy.
And then the fire of which we're very familiar with would have been, I think, July, but it was in the year 64.
Oh, in 64, okay. I read an interesting, as I was reading about him, there were actually, in the same article, there were sort of two accounts from, like, two different historians or something like that. And the second account indicated that Emperor Nero happened to be off somewhere else at the time that this occurred. As our presidents are wont to do, he rushed back to the capital city. He used his own money to help people, that he went through the streets finding injured and those that were in need of assistance without his bodyguards. And he then paid for a lot of the rebuilding of people's houses who were destroyed. He then went on a building campaign afterwards, in which he made sure that the houses were built more of stone, that the front porticos faced a wide street, and that they were more separated from one another. So we got two stories. The other one is, of course, is that he went around with a torch and lit everything on fire himself, you know, screaming obscenities or whatever, and then burning Christians and all that sort of stuff. However, it does appear that there was blame laid on Christians at that time, and the Christians were then more hotly persecuted at that time, and so it would have been during his reign. Randy?
I don't think that he was accused of running around with a torch. He had people he could easily get to do it.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But it was still rumored that he did it because he wanted a new palace.
Oh.
And the area that was destroyed, they just happened to put a new palace up there.
Isn't that nice?
What?
That was incredibly benevolent of them. So, I wouldn't put it past the guy. Yeah, but so maybe that's why he went on the building spree afterwards. I'm trying to remember whether there were a couple of emperors here that essentially ended up breaking the bank. There were one of the emperors here. It says that when he inherited the kingdom, he inherited a kingdom that had billions and billions of whatever their currency was. And then there were other emperors who just spent it down to nothing. you know, and I don't remember whether Nero's public building works were one of those that broke the empire, as it were, but they certainly were sort of footloose and fancy free with the money of the people, so to speak. So that, I think, gives us, I think, a better time frame of what we're talking about here. If we can look at the things that are going on and realize that there are actual dates associated with the things that are going on here. I have a tendency when I read through the Bible to say, okay, we're going on through and it's happened a long time ago and that's all I know. It's, oh, well, I can see now that if I look at when John started his preaching, that was 29 AD. I mean, that's a definitive time. I can look at that and say, I can understand that. Yes?
That is significant, what you just said, because what we read about here in the Scriptures did not take place in a vacuum.
No.
Didn't take place in a corner somewhere else. They were real events that happened in real places. And there were other things going on in the world at the same time. And I think it is important for us to keep that context there, because it does influence a lot of things that the Scriptures don't talk about or they hint at.
Right.
And it helps us to give a better understanding of what the Scriptures are teaching.
Yeah. I think in reading through the New Testament, we have a tendency to have a binocular view. We're looking closely at this one area, and we don't get the world view. There is a world out there. There are other people. They're doing other things. And those other people many times influence the things that we're talking about here.
Because one of the things people want you to believe is the Bible is nothing but a myth.
Right.
A myth is something a long time ago, this happened. Well, in a land far, far away. No. This happened in Korea.
Yeah. And I think one of the more important things that I look at is that we have a tendency in our history to look in history of a few hundred years. We're looking at history in the Bible of thousands of years that people know lots about. What a rich history there is. And it's all real. All right. Next week, Mickey will probably get back on the next slide. Paul's fifth defense.